You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling.
Okay, we're going. We are on subsection 6 of section 110 in Contributions to Philosophy of the Event. We're page 164. And we're ready to go.
Okay, great. So, section 110 is called The Idea, Platonism, and Idealism. And idea, we interpret basically as form. But what is the actual Greek again?
Look.
Look, yeah.
The look of something.
Yeah.
Yeah, not look like look at the lamp, but the look of something, its image.
Oh, really? I never thought of it like that.
Hmm?
I never thought of it like that. I always thought like looking, like sight, like seeing something.
I mean, it is a reference to the visual, yeah, but it's it means like the overall appearance in a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a sense, the common appearance, because it's the look that everything right. shares, right. like the form.
Yeah. Okay, so yes, subsection 6. In unity with this, the relations of the idea itself to the soul now also become clear and prescriptive. A, as look in relation to see and think, thinking. And that last part is the two Greek words, and it's interpreted as think and apprehend. So it's think, apprehend, and thinking, apprehension.
Yeah, and is there a difference between idea and eidos?
Yeah, so it looks like those are both. Well, idea is see. You mean the other one?
Yeah.
The eidos, look and idea. I saw that they're both translated as look, and I don't know the difference. Hmm. So we could look into that further or not. It's probably a variation on, yeah, look.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I take eidos as, like you say, similar to look or idea. Okay. Well, yeah. Let's keep slogging through. We'll just kind of get through this Greek.
B, as the common and community in relation to discussing and gatheredness, discourse.
Yeah, logos, discourse or language. Yeah.
C, as the good, beautiful in relation to love.
Yeah, let's look at this. So we have here, in unity with this. Now, that's obviously referring to the prior section. And the prior section basically talked about the movement beyond beingness. Into value, meaning, ideal, and value itself coming to be of the highest value. And so in unity with this, I think what he means is, you know, along with this, the relations of the idea or form or look to the soul now also become clear and prescriptive. So read A for me again.
As look in relation to see and think thinking.
Yeah. So what he's talking about here are so the first relation he talks of is the idea to the soul, or the form to the soul. And I think probably you could think of that as the way that the Greeks interpreted what the soul is. Every human has a soul, right? The soul was kind of the form of the human. So the soul kind of resided above the human, formulated, stamped, determined, gave a look and an idea and a form to what it meant for humans to be. And so that's a relationship of meaning, really, to say that that's what the soul is a hypothesis. It's not a grounded necessary fact. It's a predication. It's a relation of meaning, that the soul is a kind of the look or the form of a human. And now we have another relation as eidos in relation to, read those words again for us.
Look in relation to see and think thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, so what I see eidos, and this is kind of what I was thought, is eidos can refer to the Greek philosophical term for form or essence.
That's eidos?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what's idea then?
I mean,
are they interchangeable?
They're not interchangeable. I think they're a little different. I mean, What's the difference between look and essence in English, or form and essence in English, right? I mean, It's just they're different, slightly different takes on the same idea. And again, idea, you could translate that as idea.
Yeah.
Idea as in, you know, the general idea of things, the idea of a couch, the idea of a piano, right?
Yeah.
The ideal. So it's all just kind of form, idea, essence. But definitely an idea, there is the idea of look. The look that something has. And again, think about the idea of a couch. Well, when you think about what the idea of a couch is, it's all basically a kind of a look, right?
Yeah.
So I think we could say essence in relation to seeing or look, and is that thinking, you said?
Yeah, thinking.
Okay.
Or they also said apprehension.
Yeah. Yeah, so we see and we apprehend essences and forms. That's I think that's what he's that's the relationship he's setting up. Great. So what's B?
As the common and community in relation to discussing and discourse.
Yeah. So discussion, language, discourse. Set up the common and the community. Yeah. And then as the good and the beautiful in relation to love.
Yeah.
So these are relations set up by what we talked about last week as the kind of liberal drive to go beyond beingness and establish a realm of values, meanings, and ideals.
Yeah.
Right? And in that going beyond, that creation of value, we have these relations that are established. Form is established in relation to the soul. Essence is established in relation to seeing and apprehending. Language and discussion are set up in relation to the common and the community. And the good and the beautiful are set up in relation to love. So these are all, in a sense, outcomes or conclusions, symptoms of the liberal movement into value. Love is valued because it is good and beautiful. Discussion and logos are valued because they establish the common and the community. Vision and seeing and thought are valued because they put us in touch with essence. And the soul is valued because it is the form of the human.
Yeah.
It is a relationship of value. And of course, a relationship of value is a relationship of ideology. And ideology is identity. So it pretty much establishes the way liberalism sets up these equations of value that govern our thinking and how we interpret the different realms of existence.
Yeah.
And lastly, it reminds us that all of these things are contingent on the cognitive approach that liberalism has handed us and not necessary natural relationships, if there is such a thing. All right.
Yeah. 7, because the essence of beings is in this way gathered in the soul, the latter itself is the origin of life, and life is the basic form of beings. Here, as also in Aristotle, soul does not mean subject. Accordingly, something essential is posited with this relation of, what is that again? Sorry.
I think it's beings as being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, beings as being. A, beings as such are always the over and against, i.e. objects. B, what is over and against it is itself what is constantly present, constantly at hand, and is in the most eminent sense its being does not need to be questioned.
Yeah, so he's dipping into Aristotelian metaphysics, what Aristotle defined as the soul, how the soul and the human being, as the soul was related to what it meant to be a human being. The essence of beings is gathered in the soul of things. We still talk about soul as the essence of things. It's you know, whatever something's soul is its essence. And the soul is the origin of life, and life is the basic form of beings. So beings, soul, life, essence are all kind of clumped together into a metaphysical nexus of meaning and value. Soul does not mean subject, so it reminds me kind of like Patanjali's yogic philosophy of the different parts of the human and the different aspects, in a sense, of the human being. There's the soul and the subject, and so we think of the subject as sort of the self or the I, and the soul as an overriding essence. A soul does not mean subject. Accordingly, something essential is posited with this relation of beings as being. So something essential, meaning the soul, is posited with this relation of beings as being. Beings are always the over and against objects, as into object, or throw at, or throw against, throw toward, ject, with its etymology of throw or toss or interject, place. beings are always over and against, and what is over and against is itself, what is constantly present, constantly at hand, and is in the most eminent sense. Its being does not need to be questioned. So beings are kind of made essential objects that are constantly present to us. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a little question about that, but should we come back to it?
I don't know. Whatever. You don't ask it now. I think we should talk about it now.
I mean, when I see subject and object, I think of art. I think of, you know, I think also of how I feel like there's a, you know, the whole John Berger idea, which I think is very common refrain probably within liberalism, about the idea that women are objects, and but the goal in a way is to be a subject, is my very loose interpretation of it. And so I'm kind of curious about this idea of how we have, I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a general liberal approach would be that things are, I mean, I guess I keep thinking of like a woman, right, is an object, is seen as an object, and that's supposedly denigrating, with the goal of becoming a subject. And if that at all relates to this, or if that's just a totally different train of thought.
I mean, I think it does relate. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the whole women being an object and becoming subjects is just, you know, really just about, they're largely being only male artists. And then obviously they made women objects. And then as women became artists, they became subjects. Women are still objects, and now more women are subjects. I think that the stigma placed on women as objects is, of course, ridiculous. I think it was just used as a kind of a liberal politico activist dichotomy in order to pressure and compel people to value being a subject over being an object, because a lot of feminists felt that being a subject was more important than being an object. But of course, that's not true. That's a political preference. It can be just as fun being an object as it can be a subject. It can be just as fun being on top as it can be on bottom. It can be just as fun being looked at as it can be to look. Can be even better to be thought of than it can be to think. So, you know, it's just a lot of transient political hoo-ha. I mean, I think that I think that if he talks about beings here as always the over and against the objects, that seems to kind of probably have something to do a little bit with that might play into the rhetoric of, you know, that, you know, when you're an object, you're dehumanized. Mm-hmm. Which again is nonsense. I mean, because the fact is our what we think the subject is just an object. We objectify the subject. We subjectivize subjectize the object, objectivize the subject. The subject is an object for us. The object is you know, a subject that we relate to. So the concepts don't really hold up in a strict, shallow political sense. liberalism is kind of the game of stupidity that allows such categories to exist. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I answered your question. Does
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
I mean, what? I mean, I like that you bring up the comparison. I'm not quite sure. Like,
I mean, one thing that comes to mind for me is like one of my taglines for my art practice at one point was power through objectification, which is sort of like trying to, you know, say there, I guess in a way a little trying to say, oh, there can be power in being the object as well. I've never really loved it, but I feel like there's something there in trying to turn that on its head a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very obviously, yeah, I'm knowledgeable of your like art branding in that way, and I think that that was done to try to lend legitimacy and set up a kind of niche or an angle,
yeah,
for your work in the face of obviously the predominant agenda, which was being a subject. And you know, you come out of being a model and a dancer and a kind of a looked at person, and then you transformed into a looking person, or you were a created person, and then you became a creating person. And so you tried to bring some power and relevance to the created, looked at realm, which I think was absolutely proper, given that, you know, the messaging around that was that objects are powerless.
Yeah.
But I mean, here, go ahead.
I guess the other thing I want to mention is I feel like Heidegger is pointing out that kind of all beings become objects
in
liberal thinking. So in a way to say, oh, this kind of object is bad, but this kind of object, you know, but the others are don't matter or something. Or it's kind of interesting that that would be picked up as such a
absolutely
thing to fight against.
Absolutely. And that is the liberal lie. The liberal lie is that objects are bad and subjects are good. Because in liberalism, all subjects are trying to do is be objects, for other subjects, and it's really just a power game. How much of a can you be such a subject that you're an object for all the other subjects? Because it's the objects that are constantly present, objects that are always over and against, objects that are in the most imminent sense. They're constantly at hand. Their being does not need to be questioned. So every liberal subject really just wants to be an object. And that's the power grab that is hidden deep down in liberalism. Liberalism eulogizes the subject as if the subject's purpose and glory lies in being somehow a more moral, more valuable, more agential, more enlightened. But of course, again, the liberal subject's overarching and essential goal is to be an object to all the other subjects. I mean, in a sense, to be the ruler, to control things, to set the agenda, to determine right and wrong, etc., to lead the Communist Party.
Then what would be a post-liberal take on that relationship?
Well, you know, I think obviously the subject-object dichotomy in post-liberalism is seen as just an artifact of liberal power games. It's seen as what Heidegger here is calling a kind of ministration of value, an arche or a religion of meaning and idealism, and the subject object is just in a sense a smoke show to cover up the real agenda there. Like, let's be subjects, not objects. But of course, subjects need objects.
Yeah.
And objects apparently need subjects. I mean, because object is just another word for, it's like the N, it's just another N word, really. It's just like, yeah. It's like the liberal N word. It's just like, sure. You know, it's just, it's the new savage. It's the new deplorable. It's just, you're just an object. Subjects are rife with thinking and education and freedom and liberalism, but again, none of that is true. All of us are objects and subjects. I mean, what Heidegger is really pointing out here is you're being looked at, and you know the whole goal of like being the one that's looking, and not the one that's looked at, is also a lie, because of course the looker wants to be looked at. The looker just wants what they're looking at to be looked at so much that they're looked at. All these artists who want to be like the subject of everything, you know, again, to be the subject, think of that phrase, to be the subject of a book, to be the subject of a talk, is just to be the object of someone else's attention. So in post-liberalism, this subject-object thing is just seen as a real sort of ruse, a reactionary, revolutionary ruse.
Yeah.
I also think that, you know, dipping a little farther back into what he's talking about, I mean, what he's talking about in the top of six are prescriptive relations. That's the word he uses. And so, you know, the first prescriptive relation, and prescriptions are very liberal. Liberals like to prescribe things. The prescriptive relation of idea to soul, right, is really the prescriptive relation of identity. Identity is the new word for soul. Soul's not really used anymore. I mean, humans used to have souls in a religious sense, but the new word is identity. And so the prescription of having an identity is that your identity describes your look, it describes the idea of you, it is your soul, it's the overarching form that gives a kind of general credence and community to what you are, right? It generalizes you, it makes you a genera.
Yeah.
In post-liberalism, your identity is not a form. It's not a formulating soul machine. It's actually something I would say that in post-liberalism, your identity is a dialectic you're trying to shed, an externally imposed dialectic that you're trying to liberate yourself from. And we have eidos, or essence, in relation to idea and looking. So, for instance, in post-liberalism, the look and the seeing, the looking and the seeing, have nothing to do with essence. Essence is not relayed in the look and the see. Looks are transient, uninformative, or at least unessential. Appearances are allowed to be appearances, and they don't have to be essences. And then the B is very interesting in the post-liberal sense. The common and the community are in relation to discussion and discourse, right?
Yeah.
And that's a prescriptive relation, by the way. So discourse and logos are prescriptively related to community and commonality, right?
Yeah.
Now that prescription says discussion and discourse are only valuable, which morphs into are only ethical and only acceptable when they serve, relate to, and broaden the common in the community.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
If they are anti-common or anti-community or unrelated to the common or the community, then they are, A, they're not prescribed, right? That's not what we're prescribing. And B, they're just unethical. And then the good and the beautiful in relation to love, it's probably eros, right?
Yeah.
You know, that just reminds me of the kind of liberal, maudlin, smarmy crap about, I don't know, there's just something sort of, you know, how good and beautiful everything has to be and how love has to, you know, it's just like these, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, you know what
yeah,
I mean? Like
totally.
It's such a valuation of love. And that's my point is
yeah.
Love can be so many different kinds of things, obviously, whatever. But there's a valuation of love is that love is supposed to be good and beautiful and that, or if anything, the good and the beautiful in love is really the only value love can have.
Yeah.
In a post-liberal world, love is set free from needing to be good and beautiful and is allowed to take its routes wherever it may.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I think finally, and I mean, we talked a little bit about it in the post-liberal world, this sort of subject-object dichotomy is again seen as contingent, fabricated, and
yeah.
political. You know, I think of that whole like, sorry, somebody we know talks a lot about Martin Buber and his like. You know what I'm talking about? Somebody you and I know very well is a big Martin Buber fan, and his his thou and the his, Martin Buber's got something about like where like humans are supposed to relate to each other as a thee and a thou or something, and like they're supposed to revere each other and sacralize each other and you know bleck. It's kind of this whole thing of like, you know, we're supposed to revere each other as subjects and be, you know, be souls to each other, we're supposed to relate to each other's souls. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it's just, yeah, I think that's well said. And I think it's just really interesting that particularly this like 6-7 section can really be read as, I feel, is like almost like an art historical, like to interpret it in the context of art and how we assess and I guess critique or theorize art is interesting. Like it just kind of opened up to me this idea of like, I mean, all these words, like the look, the see, and then how that relates to the idea and the think and the thinking and then the object. I just think it's really something I want to continue thinking about.
Yeah, say more. Are you saying that a lot of the words in here are a lot of the prescriptive relations, the prescriptive value relations?
Yeah.
Are
align with how I feel like art
templates that art,
yeah.
art critics and art historians and art analysts use to interpret work?
I would say yes.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, they're all liberal.
Yes.
And I think that the problem with it all is that they use these prescriptive relations and these value connections between things like logos and community and love and goodness and essence and sight. Or looking and the preference for the subject over the object or the obfuscation of the subject's desire to be an object, those are unquestioned.
Yeah.
Those are like the textbook
yes.
intuitions that are handed art critics now, and they just use those to then filter all our work through
yes.
these templates of thought that are never questioned. And as Heidegger says, they don't need to be questioned, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why art is gone.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking if you
and why our criticism is like unbelievably
yeah, that's, that was
gone.
Thinking,
it's gone
the
even
other
more.
Day, just how I yeah. don't, there's no art in my life. There's no theater in my life. There's no literature. There's no art.
Yeah.
They were destroyed like 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I mean, it would be cool if they were to be able to, you know, emerge again. But the problem is they're buried under a pile of like a billion people all trying to smother them under these kind of prescriptive relations.
Yeah, yeah.
They're just using art to bolster, market, foment, concretize, solidify, politicize, legislate, adjudicate their prescriptive relations for everyone. Art is basically just an ideological tool now for the furtherance of these prescriptive relations.
Yeah, and I would say primarily the common and the community, and logos, like over. Like in the art context, I think the good, the beautiful, and love are not really considered any longer. There's,
you know, I don't know what those words are in Greek, but I would say that. Well, I think on the surface that one feels a little like good, the beautiful, and love. But if you really think about it, actually, again, the eros, which yes, is love, but in the Greek, eros is something a lot bigger than just what we think of as love. It's like sexual desire. It's passion. It's eroticism. It's lust. It's desire. It's love. That energy, that eros, right? Needs to be good and beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
In the eyes of the liberal critic.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right?
Yeah.
So taken broadly, what they're really saying is that you could almost just say the sexual fantasies of the art need to be appropriate.
Yeah. That's true. That's well said. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I often think, you know, we have this new thing where, I mean, we had this thing in theater recently where casting is supposed to be done according to social prescriptions.
Yeah.
I mean, you have this, I believe it's still in place. Like, you can't even be nominated for an Oscar unless a certain percentage of your cast is, racially diverse or something.
Oh, wow.
You know, and in theater, it was a little less overt, but it was very like, you know, if you're casting 8 actors, you're supposed to kind of have like 3 black ones and a couple Asians and a Latino and 2 whites, you know? It's this weird unwritten kind of racial prescription.
Yeah.
And my reaction as a person who cast a lot of plays, and they were my plays, was I cast from my pants.
Yeah.
I'm not casting intellectually. I'm not casting sociologically. I'm casting really just like, who do I want to F, you know, in a kind of deep sexual, erotic way. Now, yeah, of course, they have to be able to do my lines, but I'm amassing a core of people whose connection, who I feel connected to erotically.
Yeah.
And I don't mean in a shallow way. I don't even need to say what I mean. I think it's clear. You know, and that became inappropriate.
Yeah.
Became sociologically forbidden. Became politically incorrect.
Yeah.
So that's really a very strong thing today still.
Oh, yes, definitely.
You can even go back to, that little tale of casting goes to point A, essence in relation to look, right?
Yeah.
Literally the color of someone's skin.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Defines the essence that you're to relate to in terms of amassing or thinking about any kind of aspect of art.
Uh-huh.
So it's all there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's amazing how these, like, obviously very core essential things that how they just trickle into and form the basis of everything that we think about, like, all, like, I'm sure you could run the same on, like, science or you know, kind of almost any field, I feel like.
Yeah, well, you get this feeling that, like, it's weird hiding or talking so much about the Greeks, and you always get this feeling of the Greeks kind of being present at the beginning of this kind of 2,000-year, 2,500-year, you know, tradition of thinking and categorizing that played out and trickled down, as you say, and manifested in all these different ways. But the Greeks kind of set up the initial taxonomy of this way of thinking. And you'd really feel that Heidegger here in the 30s in Germany is present at a similar beginning. And it's somehow the beginning of liberalism. I mean, he was obviously in the middle of liberalism. But it's the beginning of some kind of contemporary liberal perspective that he's really noting the core...
The features of.
Yeah, the core features of.
Yeah, he's able to really identify... which makes it seem like it was probably, like, really happening right then as well, potentially, or he could just see it so clearly.
Yeah, it's very odd, isn't it? I mean, I don't really know enough about the history. I mean, and I don't really know enough about sort of what Heidegger's perspective must have been in terms of being, like, there in Germany with the Nazis, you know, spreading their ideology. I suppose there was some kind of counter-Nazi, you know, ideologies being propagated, at least in private conversation. And then, of course, there was definitely Western Europe and America propagating their ideologies. And then, of course, Heidegger's also sort of talking about, you know, not only ancient philosophy, but contemporary philosophy. So I don't really know. I mean, he's talking about some kind of intellectual current that I think, you know, I suppose he would say it's 2,500 years old at the time of his writing.
Yeah.
But yet, I mean... He sort of talks about the death of metaphysics. I mean, I think he takes very seriously the idea that Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and Hölderlin and, you know, what we now call the existentialists were a real first responder rupture with the history of Greek metaphysics. And he almost seems to just, I would say, where he's coming from is almost... I think most essentially from there, meaning he's like the rupture that, let's just say specifically Nietzsche kind of made and noted in the history of thought, gave us the ability to see this whole metaphysical structure from the inside out and in a brand new way. And so, you know, we are the children of this era. We are still behaving in ways that this era very much set up. What do you want to read? 8?
Yeah, let's read a little more. Yeah.
And so lastly, I think that liberal, post-liberal, I mean, I think, you know, I think Heidegger was envisioning a post-liberal world. So in order to do that, he must have had the liberal world right before his very eyes.
Yeah.
And whether that was Nazism or whether that was the liberalism of Western Europe, I don't know.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like it's both. I feel like the two are a lot more similar, at least in Heidegger's sort of broader philosophical perspective, than people care to admit.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Eight.
I mean, because let me say the last thing, because it's like, it's weird with Nazism, like, if Nazism had not carried out the Holocaust, you know, I feel like we might be able to look at Nazi propaganda and Nazi ideas with a little more cold analysis and almost discourse analysis.
Yeah.
But I think we can't even do that anymore. And so we kind of take liberal ideas seriously and Nazi ideas as just the babblings of psychopaths, which, you know, I don't deny that they were, but I think at Heidegger's time, and he was writing this before the Holocaust, you know, he was listening to Nazis and he was listening to liberals, and, you know, I think he was probably listening in stereo.
Yeah.
There was a left ear and a right ear, yeah. Basically, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because there hadn't been any atrocities yet. It was just kind of like a lot of political posturing and a lot of propaganda and Hitler babbling and screaming and about the foreigners and the aliens and the gypsies and the fags and the Jews, you know, and the liberals screaming and yelling about what they're screaming. So everybody's just screaming and yelling and establishing their prescriptive relations. The world was going insane. And I think Heidegger was just right in the middle of it, listening with both ears.
Yeah.
All right.
Totally.
Eight.
The beyond beingness as origin of beings possesses, inasmuch as it is the measure of happiness, the character of the divine and God, cf. Aristotle. The question of beings as such, in the sense of the guiding question, i.e. ontology, is thus necessarily theology.
Yeah, talk to us about that initial Greek.
Yeah, so that's actually from the section 5 that we read last time.
Uh-huh.
If you just, like, that we spent the whole episode talking about. Uh-huh. So the beyond beingness.
As origin of beings.
As origin of beings. And the beyond beingness, I believe that we were basically starting to interpret that as, like, well, you know, you just have, like, being, and then you have beingness, and then as you start to get kind of more values-driven and more, like, needing to add more to that, then you get to beyond beingness,
mm-hmm.
is my sort of connotation of what that mm-hmm. meant.
Talk more about that. I'm totally confused by that.
By what I just said?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if I ever really was that. Able to understand that. In the
oh, yeah,
section.
Right.
Well, I mean, so tell me, say what you said again and, like, try to add a few more words.
I guess, for some reason, I'm not sure why I've hooked onto this so much, but just this idea that, like, you have, I don't know, something in front of you. Uh-huh. But then once you're adding in this question of value, or let's say happiness, or trying to make it useful, or usefulness as a condition for life, once you're adding all these values onto it, that it takes it beyond beingness. It takes it to this kind of messier, values,
right.
driven level.
Right.
And yeah.
So there are beings, and then there's the beingness of beings, and then beyond beingness becomes which beings have value, which beings have meaning, which beings are ideal, which beings are not ideal.
Yeah.
It becomes a kind of a representational circus of valuation.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So
Is that correct? Or is that,
I mean, I think that makes sense. Yeah. The beyond beingness as the origin of beings. So that's interesting. So as we go beyond beingness to, let's just call it valuation, that valuation then becomes the origin of beings all over again.
Yeah.
And we start finding beings through that valuation. So we go from beings to beingness to beyond beingness to a new kind of being, or the origin of beings. Beings are kind of born anew, born again through that valuation. And this possesses, in as much as is the measure of happiness, because we are only happy according to the, shall we say, the success or failure of our valuations, possesses the character of the divine and God.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense, right? We go beyond beingness to valuation, and we find God.
Yeah.
And God becomes the symbol and caretaker and arbiter of our valuation. The divine becomes the highest value. And the question of beings as such, in the sense of the guiding question, i.e. ontology, is thus necessarily theology.
That is the study of religion, right?
Study of God. And you know, that's a, so really what he's saying is that, what?
Oh, that's a major statement. To say the question of beings then becomes the question of God.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anytime you're just talking about beings, you're suddenly questioning God.
I think you should read the next section.
Yeah.
Because I think he just really kind of continues this idea.
Yeah. 9, this unfolding of the first end in Platonic Aristotelian philosophy of the first beginning makes it possible that this Platonic Aristotelian philosophy and in its form, henceforth Greek philosophy in general, could then provide the framework and foundation for Judeo-Christian Philo-Augustine faith, and from this point of view could even be taken as a forerunner of Christianity, precisely as the paganism that has been overcome.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Actually, can you interpret it?
lost track. What he's saying is that, you know, again, this whole beyond beingness and this valuation, we talk about it as liberalism, but it's as old as Plato and Aristotle, here he's saying. And it's embedded in the Greek metaphysical outlook. And he says, you know, so what we see then is this Platonic Aristotelian philosophy provides a framework for the Judeo-Christian faith, because there's a kind of, you know, leap of valuation as creation and grounding of God as the ultimate being inherent in Platonic Aristotelian philosophy. And that, of course, becomes Judeo-Christian faith. So the Plato, Aristotle are the pagans that had to be overcome by Judeo-Christian philosophy or Judeo-Christian faith. But of course, Judeo-Christian faith is really just an outcropping or a further evolution of the Platonic Aristotelian approach.
Yeah. So basically, like you're saying, we say liberalism, but that it goes back to obviously Greek philosophy and obviously religion and Judaism. Yeah. Should we keep going on the Christianity topic?
I think you should read, well, I don't know. What do you think?
I think we could read one more. 10. Not only do Christianity and its world interpretation have here their framework and the predelineation of their constitution, but so do all post-Christian, anti-Christian, and non-Christian Western interpretations of beings, human beings included. the beyond beingness as, sorry, I missed this word.
Well,
oh, that's good. The beyond beingness as good, which means the fundamental renunciation of anything, of any further original questioning into beings as such, i.e. into being. Sorry, let me say that sentence over. The beyond beingness as goodness, which means the fundamental renunciation of any further original questioning into beings as such, i.e. into being, is the prototype for all interpretation of beings and of their determination and configuration into the framework of a culture.
In the framework of a culture, yeah.
In the framework of a culture. Moreover, it is the prototype for reckoning in accord with cultural values for the interpretation of reality in terms of its meaning, for the appraisal of ideas and the measuring up to ideals. It is the prototype for the forming of an idea.
Idea, yeah.
For a view of beings as a whole, a view of the world. I.e., it is the prototype for worldview, where worldview determines beings and dominates. Platonism is at work in an undiluted and unrecognized way, and Platonism becomes all the more tenacious when it has gone through the modern reinterpretation of the idea. Wow, I feel like he just said a lot of things we were talking about, or that I felt like we were kind of reading in or extrapolating from what he has said, and now he's just saying it.
That's right.
Yeah.
So again, Christianity has its framework and predelineation in the Platonic Aristotelian worldview, but so do all post-Christian, anti-Christian, and non-Christian Western interpretations of beings, human beings included. In other words, liberalism.
Yeah.
Because liberalism is post-Christian, anti-Christian, and non-Christian in name and approach, but we've talked about how it is in many ways the extension of Christianity. This beyond beingness as goodness, which means the fundamental renunciation of any further original questioning into beings as such, is the prototype for all interpretation of beings and of their determination, configuration, in the framework of a culture. So that sentence clarified to me what I was saying I was a little unclear about. So going beyond beingness, which really means for Heidegger, going beyond being and the abandonment by being, the abandonment of being, and the fundamental renunciation of looking deeper into being. Yeah. The beyond beingness, that's what the beyond beingness is a going beyond being, mm-hmm. and that becomes goodness, the good, what is good. And it is a renunciation of original questioning into being. So it is the fundamental avoidance of that general guiding and basic question, right?
Yeah, because beingness is just good, so you can't then question.
And going beyond being is good.
Yeah.
Yeah, to God, to value, to meaning. Yeah. And ultimately, it provides a framework for culture. And it is the prototype for reckoning in accord with cultural values. So let's look at this interpretation of beings and of their determinants. So essentially, this goodness, this going beyond, this fundamental renunciation of questioning being, becomes the framework of a culture, right?
Yeah.
So that's how a culture sort of defines itself, is the way it goes beyond being toward the good, the way it renounces original questioning into being. So culture is in a sense a renunciation of being. It is also the prototype for reckoning in accord with cultural values. So it's the template for the way we assess things according to cultural values, not according to truth, but according to cultural values. It's the prototype for the interpretation of reality in terms of its meaning. So not in terms of what it is, but in terms of what it means to us. It's the prototype for the appraisal of ideas and the measuring up to ideals, right?
Yeah.
So we appraise ideas, we determine their value, that's what appraisal is, and we measure them up to ideals. Ideas are expected to live up to ideals, and we give ideas a grade as to how well they match up to ideals. And it is the prototype for the forming of an idea, for a view of beings as a whole, right? Not specifically, a view of the world. It is the prototype for worldview, where worldview determines beings and dominates. Platonism is at work in an undiluted and unrecognized way, and Platonism becomes all the more tenacious when it has gone through the modern reinterpretation of the idea.
Yeah.
Right? So that is liberalism.
Yes.
Let's talk about post-liberalism. Right? So post-liberalism is going to take this idea of the Christian world interpretation and the post-Christian, anti-Christian, and non-Christian Western interpretation and realize that they are the same thing.
Yeah.
And that liberalism is just reactionary Christianity. And post-liberalism is, in my view, seeking to move beyond the whole contradictory binary of Christian and anti-Christian.
Yeah.
And to finally leave the Christian worldview behind. That's in my view. The Christian worldview can still exist. The anti-Christian worldview can still exist. But they are worldviews. They are not, unquestionable cosmologies. And worldviews, again, are, to have a worldview is to be recognized not as a culturally defining force, but as simply a perspective.
Yeah.
So I would say post-liberalism removes the divine authority from the realm of the divine. And that includes from liberalism. Liberalism's divine authority is removed from it. It's no longer divine. It's no longer unquestionable. It's no longer absolutely determinative. It's no longer the unquestionable prescriber of values.
Yeah.
It's just a worldview, which, and again, other worldviews include the moon is made out of cheese, the earth is flat, and, you know, airplanes, or what shall we say, Wi-Fi causes cancer. You know, those are worldviews too. So beyond beingness as the good is a fundamental renunciation of any further original questioning into beings as such. So the post-liberal view would say that beyond beingness is not the good. Yeah. There's no necessary relationship between those. And this renunciation of original questioning into beings as such is an unnecessary renunciation. It's a bit of avoidance. Something to be looked at as, you know, why are we avoiding that, right? Why are we equating beyond being with goodness? How did that happen? How did that metaphysical tendency, that habit for valuation, come to rule everything? And let's go back and engage in the original question of being. That's a post-liberal bullet point, right? Uh-huh. And post-liberalism rejects the idea that this beyond being as goodness is a prototype for all interpretations of being and of their determination, configuration, in the framework of a culture. That a culture is not
prototyped by this renunciation. This renunciation can exist as a part of culture, but for a culture to be built on a fundamental renunciation of the question of being and a being avoidant beyond being this goodness valuation is, I guess post-liberalism would say, is probably identitarian gibberish. Yeah. Or worse, identitarian enforced ideology posing.
Hegemony.
Huh?
Hegemony.
I don't know if it's hegemony or hegemony. I've always said, but posing as
freedom.
Yeah, exactly. Arts, the arts. Resistance, freedom, the arts, exactly, is a prototype for reckoning. So post-liberalism would reject reckoning in accord with cultural values. Cultural values don't establish rules for reckoning. Reckoning is about determining truth. Cultural values are about determining cultural values, and the two should not mix. Post-liberalism would reject the interpretation of reality in terms of its meaning. Meaning is something that is slopped onto reality. Reality is prior to meaning. The determination of reality should be carried out aside from meaning, outside of meaning, which is another way of saying that I would say being should be interpreted without identity. And post-liberalism would reject the appraisal of ideals. would reject the appraisal of ideas in accord to their measuring up to ideals. Ideas do not need to be ideals. Ideas do not need to serve ideals. They do not need to be ideal. Idealism does not determine ideas. They are really two separate projects that we marry at our own peril. And ultimately, post-liberalism rejects viewing beings as a whole, forming an idea of the world as a whole, and establishing a world view. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
The world view, worldviews are to be rejected.
Yeah.
There is no worldview. There are no beings as a whole. Post-liberalism rejects the worldview. Now, what is the worldview? Again, the worldview is the very liberal habit of talking about the world.
Yeah.
We hear it all the time. It is probably one of the most destructive, annoying liberal tics that there is. Is liberals talking about the world.
Yeah.
Which doesn't exist. And so they're just really talking about nothing. They're talking about a bogeyman. They're talking about a fiction. They're talking about it's maddening.
Yeah.
Post-liberalism rejects talk of the world because it does not exist.
Yeah.
And the great liberal book of the last 10 years is Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, mm-hmm. Right? It's there, right there in the title, that there is an interpretation of the world. The world is this, the world is that, the world is another thing, right?
Yeah.
All absolute nonsense. And worse than nonsense, superstition, yeah. Voodoo, lies, self-deception, delusion, neurosis,
yeah.
Movies.
Like what you think you're seeing or what yeah. you're scared to see or what yes. you're scared might be.
Yes.
Has like so many different
yeah features. Post-liberalism understands that this having a concept of the world is the beginning of dementia.
Yeah.
Middle-aged dementia.
Yeah.
Let's call it a pre-Alzheimer's dementia. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Liberal dementia. Sorry, yeah. Pardon my redundancy. Yeah. So
yeah, I mean, I know I just said it, but I think it's kind of interesting to think about it in terms of like, if you think about everything, all these projections of the world, that it's what it's like. We have no idea, right? How if it at all relates to reality. And so it really just becomes like, well, what's the thing that in a way you want to prevent from happening, or you want to like make sure it doesn't happen because it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
And
what do you need the world to be in order to justify your fear?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I had a sort of example of this recently that was like, I can't remember it, but it was, it just feels like a really common thing that you're like, oh, this bad thing could happen. So just because it might happen or maybe happen somewhere, we need to talk about the fact that it's happening everywhere, yeah. Essentially.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Well, and that's in a sense, that's inherent in having a worldview, is if something might be able to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to happen everywhere because... Yeah. Because your category, your whole categorization system is off.
Yeah.
Everything is everywhere all the time.
Yeah.
There are no events. There are no discrete moments. There are no individual beings. Everything is beyond beingness. Everything is predicated by your valuations, by your prescriptive concepts, and by your worldview. And so... To talk about it's really psychologically palpable the conduits through which this word world works. If you have a concept of the world or a view of the world, then what you're really doing is you're again establishing a generalized fiction. Yeah. That contains no, it's like a giant void, contains no friction, it contains no individual places.
Yeah.
And so if one thing happens and you're a person who has the idea of there being a world, then that one thing happens everywhere.
Yeah.
Because you only conceive of reality according to this general fiction blob called world.
Yeah.
And you can't even cognize the idea that something would happen in one place and not in another.
Yeah, exactly.
Because what's happening is not place specific for you. What's happening, and I think the word we use now for it is feelings. Mm-hmm. What's happening to you is a feeling, which is your world.
Yeah.
And so it's happening everywhere because your feelings are everything and the world is everything. And so you just are really setting yourself up to be overwhelmed, which is another way of saying your great agenda of being a subject has turned, what you really are is you're an object. You've become your subjecthood has made you an object of your own delusions and fears. You are actually what you're most scared of.
Yeah.
You have objectified yourself into a scary world.
Yeah.
And you've objectified the world into a scary thing.
Yeah.
But of course, that world is nothing more than your subjective
fantasy of it.
Fantasy of it.
Yeah.
So it's just such a lie. This the subject is great and the object is debased.
Yeah.
You know, but
everything is an object in the liberal world.
Exactly, and that's you know, I talked about the N-word earlier. What I really meant is everybody has all these derogatory terms, right? They use all these derogatory terms for all kinds of things. Liberals, of course, think they don't use derogatory terms, but yet actually at the heart of liberalism is turning everything into objects, which is a derogation of everything.
Yeah.
Everything is derogated by liberalism into objects, including liberals themselves.
Yeah.
Liberals derogate themselves into objects. Liberals derogate the world into just an object.
Yeah.
That they relate to as if it's like a robot standing in their living room.
Yeah.
you know, that they can see east, west, north, and south of. They can see the whole damn thing. It's all right there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just derogation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Which derogation is, I would say, the flip side of valuation. Uh-huh. Because valuation values certain things and does not value other things. And when those things are not, when things are not valued, they are devalued.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
And their value is denied. So they are denigrated, derogated.
Yeah. And then also when things are valued, they're, I mean, I feel like you would say, or someone would say, they're also devalued at the same time because you're doing both, and how whatever it is becomes to it just like the like happiness or something, it comes to take on in the attempt to make it a good, beautiful thing. It takes on the opposite as well.
Tell me how.
I mean, honestly, it's an idea that I haven't like loved, but it's just sort of the idea that when you're, if you're saying something like happiness is good, then you're also saying happiness is bad. Kind of that there's some of that, that while even while liberalism is valuing and saying it's for good, there's still just like because perhaps valuation and this beyond beingness, and it's just it can't really hold all the things that it's claiming. There are chips and there are cracks, but we can't admit them or we can't talk about them, but then so it's all sort of there in and of in itself
somewhere. I feel like the word Freud would use is ambivalence. I mean, you know, we are tortured by our ideals. Yeah. We're devalued by our valuations. We're enslaved and cornered by our dreams of freedom. And our highest ideals are basically debase us.
Yeah.
Liberalism is really stuck in that paradox. And so post-liberalism would say, to get out of that torture chamber, to get out of that paradox, to get out of that stuckness, we need to stop fundamentally renouncing original questioning into being. We need to stop going beyond being. We need to stop viewing culture and reckoning determined by this valuation. We need to abandon our worldview, we need to abandon identity, and we need to look for reality apart from meaning. And, you know, reality apart from meaning is very terrifying to a liberal.
Yeah.
An unmeaning reality to a liberal is like, inviting death over for dinner. It's just not their idea of fun. They need to be cocooned, they need to be coddled, they need to be comforted by meaning. And a reality without meaning is really a cold bath for a liberal, to be avoided at all costs.
Yeah.
So post-liberalism rejects that fear.
Yeah.
Rejects that cocooning, that comforting, that safe space, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I guess that's it. Right?
Yeah, I think so.
I will hit stop. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.